So this starts a 12-week series that will go into December. I keep lengthening it, extend it out, 12 weeks on actually just three suttas. And I was thinking, well, you know, at one point I was thinking, oh, I'll just do a sutta, discourse on a sutta, and then commentary on a sutta, and then we'll have a discussion and homework. And then I thought, well, no, because the suttas I'm picking have such depth and such importance that I really want us to spend some time in understanding them. So, like tonight, we're going to talk about the Kalama Sutta, but the Kalama Sutta, we're going to be actually about half the time of these 12 weeks, we're going to be on this one sutta. And so next week, if you picked up one of your homeworks, we'll do a discussion and involvement with the homework. And for those of you who are listening to this from the internet, the homework should accompany the talk that on the internet. So the Kalama Sutta is from the Anguttara Nikaya, The Anguttara Nikaya is a group of Buddha's discourses that are lumped together in terms of numbers. The four of this and the five of that and the six of this. And there actually goes up to 11 groupings. And this is in the third group of that series. Because I think you'll understand by the time we're ending that there is a sense of threeness in this particular sutta. So I'd just like to read to you the grist, the middle part, the meat of this sutta. The Kalamas were, first of all, a clan that lived in India back when the Buddha was around. And the Kalamas were kind of confused because they had lots of holy men visiting their town or wherever they were living. And each holy man was saying, this is the way, this is what you should believe, don't believe anyone else, believe this. And so they were getting a series of these through their streets. And because there were a lot of monks back during the Buddha's time, it wasn't just the Buddha's Sangha that were mendicants, but a whole series of monks from other traditions and other faiths. And so they were loaded with holy men. In fact, if you go to India now, you see the same array of people walking along. You could have a businessman in his suit beside somebody naked in ashes with a knife in his cheeks. That pretty much sums up India. So you imagine 2,500 years ago, it was even more so. But the meat of the sutta says, come Kalamas, this is the Buddha speaking, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon plausible reason, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, the monk is our teacher. Kalamas, when you yourself know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observe these things leads to benefit and happiness, then enter into and abide in those. So what the Buddha is saying is really quite interesting. I was thinking it's sort of the essence of non-centered teaching, non-self-centered teaching. Because what he's saying is, don't follow me. Don't follow me as just another line of another monk passing through your village. Don't follow what I have to say based upon what your scriptural reference might say. Don't follow anyone for that purpose. Don't follow because it just makes sense to you. Don't follow because you've been told that this person is reputable and Don't follow them because you think, oh, somebody of worthy and note has made this their teacher, therefore I will make them my teacher. In other words, don't follow them at all unless there is some part of the teaching that touches your heart. That's basically what the message is. Not because it reasons well, not because the person is fluent and elegant in speech, eloquent in speech, but rather that the teaching somehow abides in the principles of this being beneficial, this being towards the welfare and well-being of all beings, this being towards the good and the noble within myself. And this feels right from that sense of personal accountability, of personal goodness, of personal benefit. Then follow the teaching. It's such a radical statement. Perhaps the first of its kind, because of that non-self-centered approach. You can just imagine that most of those teachers back in the Buddha's time were very much about me. Come listen to my teaching. And the more people they had within their congregation, the more they could claim to be a great teacher. It was based on numbers. It was based on the principles of self and self-aggrandizement. And here was the Buddha saying to them just the opposite. And I picked this sutta out because to me it's like the lion's roar of Buddhism. It's not about proselytizing or converting or trying to convince anyone. And we basically in this sutta is the message of leaving people alone. Basically the message is not to try to convince anyone of anything, because the real work is internally in one's own sense of heart, in their own sense of integration of what the teaching is into their heart. So I just want to stay for a minute and not pass by the radical quality of what is being said in the sutta. That it's inclusive, that the Buddha is essentially saying this isn't about opinions. It's not about what you believe. It's not about what you've concluded. And therefore, when he says that, he makes it inclusive, not exclusive. It's not about my opinion over your opinion. It's not about my belief versus your belief. And therefore, when we put aside the beliefs of what we hold, it becomes inclusive. You can see from the perspective of present-day religions how radical this statement is. There's fundamentalism in most traditions and within most religions. And what they're most interested in is converting, missionary work, of convincing you that how they're standing and aligning their posture on in terms of their spiritual work is the only way to stand. I don't know if you've had people. I was a Buddhist monk in Thailand, Bangkok, coming up to renew my visa from my home monastery in the south. And I was walking along the street on alms round, and somebody from one of the sects of Christianity came up to me and walked with me, trying to convert me to Christianity as I was walking on alms round as a Buddhist monk through the streets of Bangkok. It was so, it was so sort of, I don't know what it was like. It was a Fellini movie. And I wasn't trying to argue his points or deflect his opinion, but it was annoying. And finally, I just turned to him and I said, you know, why don't we just make an agreement that we'll leave each other alone? I would prefer walking by myself. And then just turned and walked away. In the sake of salvation, what we do often is from the core of our own doubt, we try to convince someone else. If we leave somebody out, if somebody isn't convinced, then it touches that doubt. And so much of this Kalama Sutta has to deal with our self-doubt, which will be the next talk I do the week after next. Because when we have that self-doubt, and we haven't actualized or internalized or experienced the teaching. I mean, we may have had a heartfelt release of something, and we call it the salvation. Or we may have had a moment in which we feel some mystical revelation in our life. In fact, I've read where 50% of the population has had that. But it just remains at the level of something we had once, and then we keep reminding ourselves back and using that as sort of the guidepost for the rest of our lives. It becomes very quickly a memory, a milepost memory, not a living experience. In this sutta, the Buddha is talking about a living experience, not a dead thing, not a once upon a time memory, but something that's alive and awake, an ongoing revelation. In fact, that is what Buddhism is. Yes, it has a canon of teaching, and it has references to what the Buddha said as he was moving and living his own spirit of awakefulness. And each of us who have come after him do a disservice to Buddhism to align our lineage only with what he said back then 2,500 years ago. And not let it be alive in us. What's the Four Noble Truths today? The basis of the truth is there, but the metaphors and the way we understand them, the views, everything has got to be moved up and make it contemporary so it's alive, so that we don't feel it as something that's ritualistic and when I read the suttas, but speaks to us, ever present, because the living reality that the Buddha is speaking about is ever present. It's not an index for some other time. And so much, I think, of us miss that in our teaching body of insight teachers. You know, when we put ourselves on the edge, when we actually use our own words, and then to sort of back off the edge, we said, well, the Buddha said this, and then we expound around what the Buddha said, sort of as the centerpiece of a lecture. That's not wrong, but I'd like to see us more on the cutting edge. Not to deny the basic fabric of what the Buddha said. The basic fabric is what brings us all here, makes the teaching rich, makes it infinite, really, in details and. But to just sit on what the Buddha said in terms of one's lecture or in terms of one feels very dry and dead to me. And more than anything, I want to make it alive for us. Vibrant, awake. 21st century Buddhism. So dogmas. Dogma, the intention of a dogma belief, you know, yes, I'm convinced in the rightness of, first of all, you can feel the fear in that, the rightness of, yes, that's, and the doubt. And so you have to convince, we have to convince people who aren't doubting or who aren't believing, we have to convince them or they access my doubt. And because that's the worst thing possible on a belief-based tradition, what we try to do is convert everybody. Then we're all nodding our heads in unison, and then I can relax my doubt, which still permeates my system, but I try to hide from that in every way possible. I've been in scenes like that. There's no escape. Whatever you do to leave is your fault. The doors are closed. There's no realistic and legitimate way to exit. No exit. We close. No exit. And you can feel the dogma and the sense of belonging. Because when there's dogma, you look around and everybody's nodding their heads, you go, and there's this tremendous sense of belonging. Many of us feel very lonely in our lives, and we want to know that we belong to something, and if we belong to something that's noble, and which there's a large group of us, then we have we've internalized a certain nobility that we may not feel from the individual level. I was running on Saturday. I jog about mid-morning up the Burt Gilman Trail right through University of Washington. And lots of the people who were heading towards the game were walking down the Burt Gilman Trail. And they were unusually friendly to me. You know, and I was running up it and I was just kind of cursory, just, you know, nodding my head. Because I don't know whether they're people that have been in a beginning class, I don't know. So like there were signs. It said, "Real dogs wear purple." So I looked down and I was wearing purple. So I suddenly realized why everybody was... So I thought, oh, whoa. Then I thought, okay, I'm going to get into this. So I was trying, go Huskies! Yeah! And believe it or not, it had an effect. It was like I was getting pulled in to the sense of belonging, you know. But then all of a sudden I had to dislike whoever the Huskies were playing on Saturday, and I didn't even know who they were playing, and I was disliking them anyway. Oh, God. But it gave me a sense of how that sense of belonging, also called patriotism, it can be, you know, neighborhood, it can be family, neighborhood. It doesn't, wherever we draw the concentric circle around the belonging, there's that feeling. And it's so seductive. I mean, it's not a small thing. It's not a small thing because we're against evil. We're standing here. It doesn't matter whether, were we playing Idaho or whoever we were, San Jose, I don't know. But whoever the University of Washington team was playing, there's just this sense of rightness. Now, you put a religious figure, a prophet, you couple your righteousness, our righteousness, with a religious figure's, now you have Buddha's righteousness or Christian righteousness with you. And you can feel that sense of belonging growing exponentially. And that, you know, I'm ready to make a war. I'm ready to fight for this because we're right. And look, we've got the armies, you know, and oh. And so I think the two points that the Buddha was trying to make here in this sutta, really one of them was definitely about that sense of belonging from the righteous feel. You know, just because somebody tells you who has an admirable quality or holds himself or herself in a particular way can convince you that there's something otherworldly about him or her, thereby leads us to want to be, to give up our own empowerment because of our self-doubt, give up our own empowerment and empower that person to hold the gates of my own liberation. And the Buddha says, it just isn't going to happen. What it's going to cause is distress and pain for us. And it doesn't, you know, Buddhist scholar, it doesn't mean that there isn't a proper way to look at scholarship and be, because there are many Buddhist scholars who are very well practiced and who integrate the suttas into their practice so that their practice, the suttas or the points the Buddhas are making, are actual areas of investigation for the person, him or herself, so that they're using the words to come to that level of experience in themselves. When I was in Thailand, that's what I did. I just would read a sentence or two until I hit something that I didn't understand, and then I would put the book down. And I might work with that for a day or a week or a long period of time until I saw it in myself. Oh, okay. That insight. Oh, I know what he's talking about. In fact, when I first went to Thailand, I was so filled with what other teachers had told me about how to practice and the way to practice and the right methods to practice and the technology of practice and the philosophy of practice, and most of it's Buddhist related. I felt so full in my mind of the ideas of others and the others and others people's practice directives that I was just, it was almost unbearable. In fact, I remember thinking, okay, I don't care now. I'm not with anybody. There were no other Westerners in this particular monastery, so I'm just laying it down. I've got to look at everything for myself. And the first thing I looked for, and I often tell the story, I said, why does my mindfulness have to be non-judgmental? I don't feel non-judgmental. Why does it have to be non-judgmental? And as soon as you bear a judgment in terms of awareness, you see why it has to be non-judgmental, because all awareness shows you is the judgment. And so you don't see anything fresh or new. You see through the judgment. So then when you actually see that in the practice, you go, oh, of course it has to be non-judgmental. Put that one aside. What's the next piece I have to bring into my own? So we bring the practice, we make it our own through the actual experience of it. Now, there are many Buddhist scholars who work with their own meditation to accompany their understanding of Buddhism, and thereby they can expound from their own sense of what Buddhism is through their scholarship. But it doesn't stop with just what they've read. Just because the Buddha said this, they don't stop there. They go on and they have to see it themselves. And then there are a whole group of people who just arrest themselves at scholarship. There was one Western monk who was a very senior Western monk when I was there in my first year. And he had 9 years. He'd been there 9 years. And he was totally a scholarly monk, Westerner. And I said, you know, why don't you sit? Why don't you meditate? And he said, well, first you have to read what the Buddha meant before you can meditate properly. Why? Sit down there and see what your mind is. That's what the Buddha meant. Just see what's there. I didn't say that to him, but I knew, and I because he was a senior monk and because there's a certain deference that one gives senior monks, I nodded my head and just went away. But in my mind, I said, you know, he'll never come to that point when he's read sufficient amount where he says, okay, now I can start practicing, I understand. If after 9 years you haven't read that amount, you aren't going to get there. Far better just to jump in and then scream a lot, which we all do, and we find our way through it somehow, and all of a sudden it starts making sense at some point. And then the more we read, the more sense it makes in terms of the experience that we've had already. Rather than leading with what the Buddha said, we have the experience and we say, oh yeah, of course, this, oh yeah, that makes sense. So there's a rightful place of study, but we need to remember that the underlying maxim of all the Buddha's teaching was that simple statement that Joseph often says and is in his new book, cling to naught. That is fundamental to all of the teachings, simply cling to naught. And if we take that and really look at it, we begin to understand that this sutta tells us what we're adding to our experience, where we are attached to views, not to where we're relinquishing views, but where we are attached to other people's ideas as the place where we stand. I mean, that's why we give homework. Because I can give you a discourse every week, and you can come into it like a church. Nod your head, walk out, say, that was interesting. Wonder what he's going to talk about next week. And not have it reach inwardly to the fabric of what our everyday experience is. The homework, hopefully, is a bridge towards that integration. Allows that integration to take place. If it's applied, and it's difficult to apply. It's much easier for us to say, nod our heads. Then we get the self-assurance of the Buddha having said something. Retranslated, you know, or commentary on something. And when we hear Rodney speak or XYZ speak, then we said, oh, okay, he's a Buddhist teacher, he must be talking from Buddha. Then we have the Buddhist tradition behind us. And it gives us a sense of security, of assurance. But it changes nothing. In fact, it's a limitation because it's become a view, a solidified opinion, and you're ready to fight to save your opinion. You're ready to defend that opinion. Because it hasn't been integrated in the experience, it remains an opinion. And opinions always conflict with other people's opinions. And since, you see, in someone who has integrated Dharma, you don't have to defend Dharma. The Dharma is. You don't have to argue it. You don't have to defend it. There's no need to, because it is. It's like saying, there's a tree outside. No, there's not. Okay. You don't have to defend it. But if it's an opinion, then we're okay. Then we have to defend it. In order to hold our opinion, we have to defend it. And that's where the world at large is in such horrendous shape. It's because we're all moving through this life in some way or other based mostly on opinions. We haven't allowed this thing to touch our core. So what the Buddha was saying is, put a death to me. Kill me. And in Zen they say, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You see what this means? This means if you meet the opinioned Buddhist on the road, dismiss it. Let it go. Or if you meet the tradition, somebody espousing the tradition, I have no time for that. Because what we're interested in here, hopefully, is to be awake. And I don't think we're ever dead, more dead than when we're opinionated. Somebody that has a conclusion about everything, they're not open to anything. There's no sense of learning. There's no sense of life affecting one. Conclusions hold life at bay. I'm already affected. I've got my conclusions. Everything else stay out. You see how that's a wall? And it's a wall that we admire greatly in this life. And matter of fact, we say the more opinions somebody is, the more opinions a person has, the clearer they are. So this sutta really, I mean, it demolishes us, really. I mean, I love that. He says, okay, if you believe in tradition, stand in this rug. If you believe in what your forefathers have said, stand on this rug. And he just keeps having people stand on the rug, and then he takes the rug and he pulls it. It's that, when we're free-falling, that we can actually learn something. We're actually available for some learning. Because everything has to ultimately be put to an end. Everything. We have to put an end to everything. That's what it means, cling to not. The whole sense of wonder and mystery. How can we have a sense of mystery if we have everything in place in our mind, everything opinionated and concluded? To allow the mystery to come in, we have to be in a free fall. So the tradition of Buddhism puts an end to itself. Isn't that interesting? I just think that's so wonderful. Because if it didn't, it would be based on some one or something that would rob us of life. And in this way, it directs us towards our own strength, our own empowerment. Now that's, I want to offer some caution in that. Because mostly people who are interested in this tradition have authority issues anyway. And they're waiting for a sutta like this to get on their cowboy hats or cowgirl hats and to be free-spirited. And you're not going to tell me anything. And that self-reliant, independent manner can be as closed, listen, can be as closed down. It's really an opinion. It's another conclusion. It's a set, and it's a set of fear. For some reason, authorities have betrayed us in the past and we become insulated in our own individuality and no one's going to tell us what to do or how to do it. And we think that is what the Kalama Sutta is pointing at. It's not pointing at that at all. Where, how is that being open? How is that being inclusive? That's being as dismissive to those which we say are authority. It's just another, you're just going negative instead of positive. Instead of embracing, we're just negating. See, you can't use the words to find a place to stand. That's the point. Okay, I know now what he means. Don't anybody tell me what to do. You see, it's not that. If we stand somewhere, we've missed the point. And that's much more exciting. Isn't that more exciting? I mean, if we all get over there and stand over there, that would give us a sense of protection and belonging and all the other things I've talked about tonight, but it wouldn't give us any sense of real validation of life. It would give you the validation of your mind. And what's that? And so this sense of self-doubt, which we will explore in a separate lecture, there is the kind of doubt that says, I wonder. I'm not going to take anything that someone says as fact. And this is the doubt that the Buddha is talking about in this sutta. Let me see. Let me see for myself. Okay, I hear what you're saying. I will hear it. I'm not dismissing it. I'm not saying, go away, you're no good. You're authority. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm listening. But I'm going to see. Now I'm going to see. So I hold a doubt. The doubt is the willingness to hold wonder. And okay, let me look now. And I think that's what happened to me when I was in Thailand. I was so filled up that there was no room for anything. And so I had to start doubting to clear out the space for other things to be there. And you see, what I love about this sutta is that it points to the heart. Because the last thing, if it's for the benefit, if you know by practicing it, you become kinder. You see? You become more caring, more affected by things, more inclusive, not more exclusive. Then you know it has a benefit. If you can look at someone who has practiced more than you and you see that they are benefited by this, then you can listen to how they're pointing out the way, says the Buddha. Don't just take their words, but listen to what they're saying in terms of pointing out their way and then go integrate that experience for yourself. But it's pointing to the heart, not the mind. That's what this sutta is really about, pointing to the heart. The Buddha says, okay, none of this, go here. Go here. Make this your seed. Make this our seed. Does it work for the benefit of people? You can just listen. Listen to the different spokespeople of traditions and just feel whether what this person is saying, and I don't mean just, you know, listen to the different spiritual traditions. Is this for the benefit of all? Is this for the well-being of all? And finally, it opens us to free inquiry. One person said about this sutta, the instructions of the Kalamas is justly famous for its encouragement of free inquiry. The spirit of the sutta signifies a teaching that is exempt from fanaticism, bigotry, dogmatism, and intolerance. Now, the sutta is on the website. I didn't bring copies for people. But go to this website and read it, or go to wherever you can access it on your own, like some of the websites outside of Seattle Insight. But please get a familiarity with this. Because really, free inquiry is the basis for lay Buddhism. I don't think it's encouraged or reinforced enough in this tradition on retreats. Because on retreats, there's a different frame of reference, and with the stillness, the inquiry is there every time you look down, when you look inside. What is this? What's going on? But when you're a lay person and you have multiple activities and pressures upon you throughout the day, the method of free inquiry, which is another talk I'm going to be giving on this sutta, is extremely important because it keeps us open. See, when we ask a question, any question, there is the need that most of us have for the answer. Now, we have a need for the answer, to answer a question. Why? Because we want to feel secure. We feel insecure in not knowing the answer. We feel insecure. We need to know. And so we try to find an answer so that we can settle, be secure, our knowledge is in place, and then we can go on to the next question. And in that format, we build more knowledge. We don't build a deeper question. In Buddhism, what we're trying to do is build in wonder. W-O-N-D-E-R. Not W-A-N-D-E-R. Wonder. So to ask ourselves a question is to take a seat in that wonder. And so the homework this week points towards establishing that wonder in your Dharma practice. And then, it's not so important about the answer. The answer may come. It'll come through quietude, through stillness, through your nourishing the question. It'll come on its own. You don't have to look it up. And you can ask yourself any question. Like, is there anything permanent in this life? And then, just in holding the question, yes, it's not, doesn't feel, it feels a little unsatisfying when you hold the question because it's a little bit insecure. So we just hold it anyway. And we look around through that insecurity. And then we're in the realm of the heart. When you answer the question, you're in the realm of the mind and knowledge. When you hold the question, you're in the realm of the heart. The question, it has to be a question that interests you, a question that there's some passion about. When you hold the question, then it moves down. The energy moves down, and there's a kind of living question, living the question, living the wonder, living the mystery. And that, I think, is more pertinent to this sutta because the Buddha is saying, look for yourself. Open your hearts. See for yourself through the question, through the wonder, through the mystery, not what people are saying, not what's in the literature, not what's in your scriptures, not what other people have said, not what your best friends tell you, not what you've been convinced, not what you're hearing now. But hold the question. As soon as we hold the question, we're alive. What is this? We're alive. And the question, what is this? As soon as we got the answer, we're dead. So that's what we want to do, is to bring forth that sense of living vitality through questioning. And that's where the sutta points. It's really an amazing sutta. It's the lion's roar, from my point of view. Radical. In which he says, he puts it into himself. It's not about me, he could have said. It's about your own aliveness and actualizing that potential. Can we sit for a minute or two?